you know, if you go anywhere in China to like the countryside and like Qinghai, you know, people are going to have 5G in their home. You know, Thailand has almost completely solid 5G everywhere because of China, because of Huawei building that infrastructure out. But there are places in the United States where, you know, someone can't afford it and they live in the countryside. It's difficult to access, so the costs are high. So they're not going to have access. I think that's it's not just bad for those individuals, for those retirees or veterans or handicapped people or whatever it is. Mm. It's actually really bad for the U.S. economy.
Welcome to The Bridge. Fun conversations on culture, life, and everything in between.
Find us where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, then consider pushing the like button or giving us 5 stars. Suggestions, comments, anything you would like to share, email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. We love The Bridge.
As soon as May 2024, more than 23 million U.S. households risk being kicked off their internet plans and face skyrocketing bills that force them to pay hundreds more per year to get online access in the U.S. without action by Congress. Those most likely to be affected are veterans and the elderly. Does it really make sense in the 21st century that so many would suddenly be cut off from the internet? What do you think, Alex?
The funny thing is we had to reschedule our recording for the first time when we tried to record it a couple of days ago because I had internet problem, and that gave me a huge panic for the very short 10 hours that I didn't have Wi-Fi. It wasn't even just completely me being cut off from internet. It was only my Wi-Fi network that wasn't working, and that was a huge problem. I can't imagine anyone in today's world would be without access to internet at all.
It's like water at this point. You know, it's like electricity, water, food, shelter, internet.
Pretty much, especially with everything they're pushing for, like mobile payment and any sort of scanning, any sort of like identity. Banking. Yeah, banking, a lot of it. So it's not just like, oh, I can't, because my parents still think, oh, internet, it's just an entertainment. It's not that anymore. And think about everything else that's going on. It's really hard to just make it something really light and say, yeah, sure, live without internet for a couple of days. I can do that. It's really, I want to try it, but I know that it's a lot harder than it sounds.
And in China, like 60% of people live in major urban centers. So we live in Beijing, you know, there's 20 plus million people here. And if we need to do banking or go to like the tax office or go to the retirement office or all these kind of things or go to a major hospital, it's like not a problem. You just get on the subway and you're there. But in America, there are, you know, tens, if not hundreds of, you know, 100 million people plus out in the suburbs, out in the countryside, living in forests, literally. And so a lot of these people, you know, if there's some kind of issue they need to handle, if they don't have internet, that means they have to drive like 2 hours to get to a city. It's, you know, it's a big deal to be without internet.
I know. But the funny thing is here, if if we need to go anywhere, you need your phone to be on an internet to do anything at all as well.
You know, I just wanted to mention that San Francisco Mayor London Breed had just recently visited China, and she's one of the things that she's trying to do is get a panda to bring back to the San Francisco Zoo. Oh. I don't think she will be successful, in my personal opinion. I'm not sure, because the only pandas that they're currently giving to the United States are to the San Diego Zoo, and San Diego Zoo is like maybe the best zoo in the U.S. I cannot say that about the San Francisco Zoo, so I'm not sure if they have adequate facilities to take care of such a sensitive animal.
I know. I think we've mentioned that I did attempt to go see the pandas when I was in D.C., not San Francisco. But I got there too late and the pandas, quote unquote, got off work. So I didn't see them. But you just see a lot of, not a lot. I shouldn't say that. But there have been cases where the pandas were given to a foreign country. And maybe it's because their ways of raising animals are different. I'm not sure why, but it just seems like the pandas are not living as, they're not as lively, they're not as active. But when they were finally able to come home, it's just kind of like, oh, this is my land. And they have a, you know, they're a lot cuter.
I think after the in the controversy, let's put it that way, in Memphis with the pandas there, I'm not sure that the Chinese people are willing to allow pandas to go to breeding programs or zoos or, you know, other countries where it's not entirely certain that those pandas are going to be given like the best care possible.
I mean, we will trust all the good intentions if you say we really want to have a panda in our city. But again, it's hard to take care of them because they're such a particular animal. They don't exist anywhere else. You know, they only exist here. And then if they're zoo pandas, it's different than wildlife pandas. I guess we have to put quotation marks on wildlife because they're not like living completely in nature, because the nature is kind of built and protected for them as well. They're just so particular. They're just so funny. No other animals eats the way they do.
You know, I want to add something really bizarre from the story about San Francisco Mayor London Breed. And I didn't know until I read this article. San Francisco and Shanghai are sister cities. I thought that was really bizarre because you would assume it would be like Shanghai is like one of like China's most advanced, super modern, postmodern cities, that it would be linked up with a city like New York or something.
You know, the funny thing is a lot of people say Shanghai reminds them of LA or San Francisco. So it's kind of maybe that's why. And then I didn't know. I wasn't surprised at the fact that they were sister cities. I was kind of surprised that they've been sister cities for 40, 45 years. And that's maybe when Shanghai's like all of these little shops that people are so proud of when they first came about, it probably was thinking, oh, maybe we can make it look like San Francisco. I'm not sure. I'm guessing, but no, but.
Well, you know, they have major water features. I guess that's
maybe, that but that's just, you know me, Jason. I'm just trying to say that the shops are overrated in Shanghai.
Well, I want to switch back to internet a little bit, you know, because I'm currently, I have home Wi-Fi, firstly. I don't use it because it's like one of those Wi-Fi that comes with your home. So you, in some apartments in China, you just move in and there's like Wi-Fi there, right? Because that's how the deal works. And I was like, this Wi-Fi is not up to standard. It's 5G, but it's not that good.
Yeah.
So I got my own portable 5G hotspot. And China now has 5.5G and they're working on 6G. And like, I literally took my portable Huawei 5G network with me to the Himalayas.
Wow.
In Tibet. Yeah, in Xizang. And I went up to the mountains and I'm at a glacier in the Himalayas, you know, 4,000, I don't know, it's whatever it is, feet or meter, I can't remember, 4,000 something above sea level. Like, there's nothing there. There's no cities for like 100 kilometers. And I have perfect screaming 5G internet. Like, I can access anything, anywhere in the world on my phone right there. And the reality is that the United States doesn't even really have 5G yet. The United States is still primarily using 4G for its, you know, Wi-Fi. So it's really bizarre that 23 million Americans, because of a law that was enacted by Congress a few years ago, will suddenly be without internet. How is it even possible? Because at this point, I think, you know, if you go anywhere in China to like the countryside and like Qinghai, you know, people are going to have 5G in their home. You know, Thailand has almost completely solid 5G everywhere because of China, because of Huawei building that infrastructure out. But there are places in the United States where, you know, someone can't afford it and they live in the countryside. It's difficult to access, so the costs are high, so they're not going to have access. I think that's, it's not just bad for those individuals, for those retirees or veterans or handicapped people or whatever it is. Mm. It's actually really bad for the U.S. economy because, yeah, sure, like this veteran may be in a wheelchair and not have the access to the world in the way that everyone else has. But if they have internet, they can maybe make a living, right? They can find functional work, or they can build their own website, or they can be interacting with the community.
They can
daily.
Go on TikTok.
So they could actually build an account on TikTok or YouTube or whatever and talk about their life and experiences or sell products. So there's so many options for them to stay engaged with society that it seems bizarre in this day and age in the United States, probably, the wealthiest economy by nominal terms. That's one of the ways that it's measured. And if the wealthiest country by nominal terms is not able to provide 23 million of its citizens with internet, when like some developing countries in, you know, every continent in the world have 5G faster internet that's more affordable. It's absolutely bizarre to me. Mm-hmm. As an American, how are we not taking care of this? I mean, I don't mean to be critical, but I think the job of Americans, if you know Americans well, is to be critical of, you know, what's going on in our country. And as an American, I'm kind of appalled that we've allowed our internet to get to this, you know, state where it's behind the rest of the world, and we're letting down our fellow American citizens. Yeah, just citizens.
Even for having access to internet alone, I remember when I was living in the United States, and this was, I moved there over 12 years ago, and the entire time I was there, I kind of was thinking about how expensive internet was. But because I was in the country, I wasn't paying any internet bills back home here in China, so I didn't really compare. But I think back then I was paying, if I remembered correctly, I was paying like about $60 per month, if not more. Wow. It's a huge bill. So we always had to split it between the roommates, and still like every month I'm paying $30 or something for internet. But back then it was already, you know, advertised by Comcast as, oh, this deal that you're going to have. And then when I came home, I think when I visited in 2015 or 2016, when I came home during the break, and I asked my parents, and they were like, oh yeah, we're paying 1300 kwai like every year. That's quite a lot. I was like, for a whole year, that's nothing. And now even nowadays, I think I have like the faster internet, I'm paying about,
for our listeners, it's about $180 a year. That's what she was saying. Yeah.
Yeah. For the whole year. Yeah. For the whole year. Thanks. That puts things in perspective. Even now, I think I am paying about like $200 or $220 per year for my really fast internet.
I would like to compare too, because these people who in the United States who are going to have to switch back to paying potentially, if the affordable connectivity program is not renewed, will have to pay a lot more, maybe more than 60 in some cases, because they are in difficult places oftentimes to get internet. It costs more to get internet there. I'm holding a device right now. It's called Great Wall. It says 5G on it. And you can get this in China. And this is going to shock even you, because your parents are paying double what I'm paying. Now, firstly, your parents are probably paying for their phone line and the internet. It's all like a package deal. So I have two phone lines, which are different than this. Uh-huh. They're completely separate from this in my phone. I have two phone numbers. I don't even know what I pay for them. It's almost nothing, because those ones don't come with Wi-Fi. If I want Wi-Fi on those chips, I have to pay for it. So it's just a phone number. And then I use this device, which I bring everywhere with me in addition to my phone. And it is a portable 5G hotspot. It's also a battery. So it's like, it just can work for more than a day or two. But I charge it every night anyway. But I want to explain. It's about 700 RMB, which is about $100, for unlimited Wi-Fi access everywhere I go, 5G, infinitely for the 1 year. So, like,
what?
Yeah, eat that, guys. That's exactly. I don't know why more people don't have these. I think people go into China Telecom or China Unicom and they're like, oh, I want a deal. And then they sell them these packages where they give you a phone number and link it to your Wi-Fi, and your phone is your Wi-Fi and all this stuff. But there are actually more affordable options if you don't mind carrying an extra device around with you. So I usually wear like a suit coat or whatever, and in one of the inside pockets, I'm carrying a 5G hotspot on me. Oh. And so that's just linked to my phone, and then there's no limit. So it's not like, you know, it's like 20 days into the month and you're like, I need to add another, I don't know, gig or something to my use. Instead, I just use it as much as I want all the time, carelessly, and it doesn't matter. That's actually why my wife got it for me. My wife arranged me to have this. She was like, Jason always goes over his limit. He doesn't pay attention. He's clueless. So I'll get him this device so that he can just use it as he can continue to be clueless.
That's a good information for a lot of people, because I think with the portable 5G, do you call it an emitter or whatever you call it?
I don't know. It's a portable hotspot. That's what they call it.
Hotspot. The hotspot, we only think about it for like a traveling necessity. We think about, if we're going to like the mountains, like you said, or if you're going to, most of the time, if we're going to a another country. And we're not sure if our phone's going to work there, although that's changing as well as more and more countries start this mobile service agreement with China. You can just go using and stay on your phone, on your original SIM card. You don't have to change. But before, even when we went to Singapore last year, we weren't sure if our phone's going to work. So we just rented these kind of hotspot and we brought them with us so that it's easier, so that we're always in connection with the internet. But it's good to think about it as a home Wi-Fi device. I never thought about it that way. And it's cheaper. It's cheaper.
It's an everything Wi-Fi device for me. Yeah. It's an everything Wi-Fi. Yeah. And it was really cool also. I was traveling with a group of journalists. We were traveling around in Xinjiang in the desert, right? And they were like, oh, I have no internet. I need to upload these content for this and that different website and stuff. I was like, just, you know, this is my Wi-Fi. Boom. And they just all linked up to it. There's like a bus full of people using my Wi-Fi. It didn't slow me down at all because, you know, 5G is, you know, insanely fast. And everyone was like, we're driving through the desert on a bus.
How
and
kind
everyone's
of you.
Using my Wi-Fi. Like it's like everyone, you know, obviously all you have to do is when you get to the hotel, just change your password and boom, you know, it's all yours again.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to talk about the law, actually. So this is from a CNN article, March 23rd. Millions of Americans could soon lose home access if lawmakers don't act, by Brian Fung. So in this, it talks about individuals. There are a bunch of individuals, and they are examples of people who might lose their internet. One of them is Cynthia George, 71-year-old retiree. She fears she might soon have to make a difficult choice, buy enough food to feed herself or pay her home internet bill. So she's literally going to have to choose between being able to talk to her like kids in Florida or whatever, or like, you know, eat. So that's not a choice that people should have to make. You know, we live in a day and age where, at least in the developed world, we have plenty. So why can't we make sure that everyone has access to that? And I think that makes a lot of sense. So, okay, it's according to this, the looming disaster could affect nearly 1 in 5 households nationwide, or according to this article, 60 million Americans.
That's a huge percentage. Americans.
That's insane. I don't think they're going to be cut off from internet. They're going to be essentially cut off from massive discounts. So the government has stepped in for very remote people and like said, okay, we're going to make it so you only have to pay like $30 a month instead of $100 a month. So now a lot of people are going to be like, well, you know, I have to choose. I can't afford to eat. I can't afford to, or I can't afford to pay my rent or whatever. Or I can have internet. And that doesn't make sense economically, because not only are these people participating in the economy for themselves, but all economic activity by all U.S. citizens contributes to the growth of the U.S. economy. So if, you know, 1 in 5 households are suddenly dramatically affected by internet outages, that's going to hurt the U.S. economy.
Yeah. And even though it says that, you know, it's not that they will completely be off the internet, like, you know, in general, they just won't have home Wi-Fi. I don't know what it is like now in the United States, but I remember I was very worried about the data usage on just my mobile plan on my phone on the number with AT&T.
It's so expensive. US Mobile. Wow. It's
I don't
insane.
Know if they changed it. Yeah, they're definitely but it's gonna be crazy. Like you were saying, oh, if they just don't talk to their kids, because these people, they would probably use FaceTime more than anyone else if they are at the age they are, right?
Right, yeah.
And
sure,
using that with just your mobile data, I mean, at least when I was in the United States, I would not do that very often, because it's just a skyrocket your phone bill.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think it's unfair because the U.S. has, you know, in terms of a lot of other countries, one of the most expensive internet access like sets in the world. I think maybe a lot of those big companies just need to be broken up in order. I don't know. A lot could be done, but it's very expensive. In order to approve the bill, which would maintain current access to U.S. telecommunications, Congress would need to pay $6 billion. Now, that sounds like a lot to normal people. Wow, $6 billion. But actually, if you look at U.S. spending, that's nothing. That's like less than 0.1% of U.S. spending, way less. So the United States spends an enormous amount on all kinds of other things. This $6 billion goes to probably create tens of billions of dollars in economic activity on the internet. So it is a good investment in the United States to give access to people. This isn't one of those programs where the United States is taking the money and shuffling it away to some corrupt bureaucracy where it's going to disappear in the Pentagon. This is one of those things where it's directly impacting real American people, everyday people, your neighbors, and it's going to help everyone and the economy grow. So this is not something... This is the kind of program that we should have in the United States.
I don't really understand why it's always going to the people when there are fiscal problems in the government, that it's always the people that have to directly suffer when they decide to do. We've talked about, you know, we've talked about health insurance, medical care. We've talked about education. And now, like, now internet is kind of like, okay, what other living basic necessities is being taken away just because things didn't work? There are a lot more other things that they have a much easier agreement on. I'm not going to say specifically what, but it's a hot topic in the States recently. But when it comes to things like this, they're like, oh, let's just take it away from people. That thinking process is quite fascinating.
I think the reason CNN and other news agencies are raising this as an issue is because they're trying to alert it's part of the American discourse. Alert American people what's going on so that congresspersons are incentivized to do what's right. Because imagine this. Okay, see, American politics and Chinese politics work very differently. Chinese politics, they create these 5-year plans, 10-year plans, 2-year plans, 1-year plans, and then they execute these plans in concert with the other plans, and that's how government moves forward. In America, it doesn't work like that. It works from election cycle to election cycle, trying to stay elected. So people usually, the elected representatives usually are worried that if they do the wrong thing to their constituents, then there will be a consequence. The consequence will, they will not be reelected. So congresspersons who vote against this $6 billion initiative are more likely to see their votes go down. So there's a possibility that, if it's going to affect 1 in 6 Americans, then they're going to be like, ooh, let's just pass this one because I want to stay in power.
That's very sad.
Oh, yeah.
The best military commander is not he who fights 100 battles and wins every one of them. The best military strategy does not lead to the desiccation of the enemy's capital city. Decoding the Art of War will help you understand why there's no art in war and how Sun Tzu stayed undefeatable using the science of war, with fun stories and insightful breakdown of famous battles. Tune in to Decoding the Art of War on Spotify.
Listening to The Bridge.
This is from the article, Military Families, Older Americans, and Rural Residents Are Most at Risk, with military families accounting for, and this is from the CNN article, almost half of the ACP subscriber base. So one thing that Americans generally get behind is that military personnel, I think this is true in most countries, you know, there's a great deal of respect for people who go out there and spend years of their time protecting their home country. So there's a great deal of respect for a military family. So I think it's also going to incentivize Congress to likely pass this bill. So I think it will probably end up getting passed because the elected representatives don't want to be seen as anti-veterans and so forth. But one thing that's concerning for me, a larger picture here, is this: even if they do pass this and save this bill, there's a larger issue. America is still way, 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 way behind on internet speed. Now, if you have, plug-in, totally wired computers that are hooked up to, or you have your own personal Wi-Fi system in your house, a Wi-Fi emitter, that's fine. But if you're pulling internet out of the air, which is a lot of the case in rural areas especially, then it's much more expensive. So, and it's also, it works less well. So yes, if you're living in a major American city, your internet is pretty fast because you're not using Wi-Fi. You know, you're plugged into the matrix, right? But if you don't have access to that, if you're pulling it out of the air, then the quality is considerably behind the rest of the world. Because even though, like, the UK and a few other countries were like, okay, America, we won't cooperate with Huawei, most of the world did buy Huawei telecommunications infrastructure. And so there are places in like Africa, South America, Central America, which have way faster internet than America has. And it's really bizarre. Yeah. Like, I just, it's just doesn't make a lot of sense. If you're trying to grow your economy, you want to have everyone have access to the latest most cutting edge technology. And it's another one of those things like rail, where the United States has not been investing in its infrastructure and it just keeps falling behind. And one of the reasons it does that is because it's like, we're not going to buy this from that other country. We're not going to buy that from this other country. We're going to sanction those people and those people.
A free market.
And yeah, exactly. So they're cutting themselves off from technologies that are already outpacing them and like, you know, other in developing countries. Developing countries in some cases have better infrastructure than the United States. Nigeria has high-speed rail. The United States does not have high-speed rail. That's, you know, bizarre.
It's a really ongoing argument. A lot of people are saying, you know, the U.S. phone, especially mobile data speed, is faster and the Wi-Fi is blah, blah, blah. I haven't been back for a long time. I really want to go and see how everything is like for myself so I can stand by whatever argument I have with proof and say, hey, I have both. I've experienced both and it's really not that fast. I would love to see it because some of my friends are, you know, huge supporters of the mobile data speed in the United States. They're saying it's a lot faster, but we'll see.
Well, you know, I get this feeling when I go back to the United States periodically every few years that it's exactly the same as when I left it, which is not bad or not great. You know, it's like I show up and I'm like,
it's nostalgic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nostalgic. It's like nothing changed.
Always.
You know, it's the same Taco Bell there and the same diner there. And I was on Amtrak. You know, okay, I used to take Amtrak a lot when I was in the States. And I was like, yay, Amtrak is great. For someone who doesn't like cars, I could travel like, you know, to a distant location and be on a train. And it was almost like romantic to myself, traveling alone, a romantic time with myself. That sounds weird. But I would be like on the car reading it. reading a book, and I was like, yay, I get there and it's great. I get off the train and I'm in another city. Woohoo.
Yeah.
Then I came to China and I'm like traveling at 350 kilometers per hour, watching the ground around me fly by so fast you can't make out things that are too close. It's just a blur. And then like I go back, right? And I'm like, wow, this Amtrak is like a chunk, a chunk, a chunk, a boom, chunk, a chunk, a chunk, a chunk. Like, oh my God. It's like you need that perspective, that context of traveling to like Europe or Japan or China to feel like what modernity really is like before you realize how ancient American infrastructure really is in some
and
cases.
And to add on that, I think you definitely heard about the speed raising for the bullet train between Beijing and Shanghai. They're going to be able to travel at the speed of 400 kilometers per hour very soon. That means from Beijing to Shanghai, if you take the bullet train, it only take you 2.5 hours.
It's actually a completely different line. They're building a maglev line. It's going to be capable of 600, but it's probably going to be like 450.
That's insane.
Usually they push the train really hard on its first few days of opening and then slow it down to its normal speed. So most like the trains that we take that are 350 kilometers per hour right now in China, they are capable of traveling 450, but for safety reasons and so forth, and
they don't go that fast,
they travel at a much safer speed. But the maglev line is going to be capable of, you know, much faster speeds. It's going to travel slower.
That's scarily fast.
Yeah, it's frightening. It's faster than an airplane, and so if it was going above its actual the speeds that they're going to use it for. So you're gonna and there's I was talking to this guy David Fung. He is called the train guy. He loves this name. Actually, I think he calls himself, sorry, the trains guy, because he says there are different kinds of trains. And so he is an expert from Sweden who lives here in China, and he writes reports about the trains, and he does a podcast about trains, and he works with the train authorities here in China, helping them name the stations and do the signage and stuff like that in English and other languages, and helps them with their website and so forth. He's a consultant, kind of. And he said that there are already these cordoned off areas between Chongqing, Shanghai, Beijing, and I can't remember the other city. Maybe it's Guangzhou.
That's crazy.
And there are going to be maglev lines between all of them by 2035. There will be what he says, ultra high speed trains. And I said, oh, is that going to be all maglev? And he said, maybe some of it will be Hyperloop. So
what?
Yeah. So the China may have Hyperloop and or maglev very, very soon. The Shanghai Beijing line is the first line of the super high speed train. I mean, we're supposed to be talking about internet. What's really cool is if you're on this is I think a lot of people might be surprised by this. If you're on these currently existing 45,000 kilometers of Chinese high-speed rail, some of which travels at 250 kilometers per hour, some of which travels at 350 kilometers per hour, there's Wi-Fi on the train. So you don't even have to have Jason's goofy gadget.
Yeah.
You can just sit down and lock into the Wi-Fi and start playing on the internet.
Yeah. And it's all free. You don't have to pay for anything. You don't have to have a...
Well, you pay for your ticket, but yeah.
If you put it that way, then it's quite expensive. Wi-Fi, Jason.
Yeah, but that's really cool because, you know, you can be traveling. You get traveling between two cities almost as fast as an airplane. And, you know, the whole time you're locked into Wi-Fi. I would rather travel by train and have Wi-Fi the whole time than get on a plane and just be like, this is the movie? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, pretty much. And then the Wi-Fi, it really, a lot of people, just very quickly, a lot of people like to travel on the bullet train, not just because of an easier security check process. A lot of people, they are able to work on the bullet train. If they're just doing, you know, like a business trip, intercity, then they just spend the hour where they're waiting for the train that they're not on the computer for. And then once they get on the train, they just pull out their laptop and they start working. And you see that a lot, actually.
You know, I think... For me, I can just work on my phone at this point. Like, phones are so advanced. I don't even need to pull out my... I bring a laptop usually for the hotel.
Oh, I hate that.
You know, like, I set up my gear at the hotel, and I have a full office there. But on the trains, I'm just, like, on my phone, and it's like, you know, that's fine with me. Okay, so in terms of Wi-Fi in the U.S., I think that there's so much more to the story than just, you know, because I think you have one in six people being affected, one in six families being affected, one in five families being affected. And most people are probably going to be like, okay, what do I have to do? I guess I just have to eat less or like, you know, whatever to make or...
That's so insane to think.
It is insane. For millions of Americans, their solution, because they still need to access the internet, like you mentioned, it's not going to be to pop open their phone and use their SIM card because that's too expensive if they can already not afford home Wi-Fi. So a lot of them are going to be going to libraries. So U.S. public libraries, instead of being a place for books, are going to be a place for people who can't afford internet. And so I read this in an article that people are going to be showing up at libraries or parking in fast food restaurants or outside of Starbucks in their cars and using Wi-Fi from there. So your grandmother, if this bill doesn't pass, will have to go into town and hang out at the library instead of sitting on the sofa from the comfort of her own home. That's going to cost money, too, because they have to put gas in the car.
Drive there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an all around kind of unhealthy situation. I've got another story.
Yes.
This is Michelle McDonough. This is from the same CNN article. 49 years old, works part time at a tobacco shop in Maine and lives off Social Security disability payments. She is one of the statistics class. Is one statistics class away from earning an associate's degree in behavioral health, but she will. She goes online virtually to take her classes, like a tele, and she meets people through telehealth visits. Mm. But if the bill doesn't pass, she will not be able to finish her degree, and she will be cut off from the opportunity to work from home. So she will remain on disability instead of becoming a participant in the economy, where she becomes. A behavioral health specialist. So we're literally hurting people's opportunity to be taken off of government
subsidies.
This is
what I don't really understand, and maybe because I don't know enough. But see, let's say we have a problem here in China, let's say. We have a problem there that it's affecting how people could survive. Usually, if a policy is carried out by the government, the policy just kind of works, you know, because it has considered or calculated whatever that's needed for this to happen. And it's never the case where the government says, oh, you know, this doesn't work for people to survive. Let's raise money. Let's somehow find this money. And let's just give people, quote unquote, discount on what they need to pay for. But there's only so much. If you can't find other sources, then this plan has to stop. And then it's not my fault. It become kind of like, okay, I'm only going to be responsible for it for a couple of years. And as long as that makes sense and then that bill gets passed, it's a little it just seems too periodical, or it just feels too short term to be a good solution. I remember I felt the same way when the U.S. said that they were going to give their citizens just cash money for COVID. That's going to help with the unemployment. I'm like, no, that's not going to help with unemployment. Just because you give them 1 month of groceries and utilities, it's not going to just automatically magically bring them back to their feet and solve their problems for the next like 4 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It just always seems like a very temporary solution that's being put in place for very critical issues.
I completely agree with you. I think most people actually agree that it was a mistake to give those cash handouts. It should have come in the form of different kinds of help that was rolled out by the government. Plus, there was an enormous amount of corruption. But I mean, talking about the kind of Band-Aid approaches, even this bill, which I think should be passed, well, other thing, the Affordable Connectivity Program, it's my personal opinion that it should probably be passed. There's a much bigger issue here, and we touched on it quite a bit, but the United States needs to build the telecommunications infrastructure and break up some of the huge companies that are requisite to bringing better quality Wi-Fi and service to the United States that is more cost effective. I think part of the reason they haven't, and this is just one part, is Elon Musk keeps saying that he's going to make Wi-Fi magically rain from space, and that hasn't been affordable for most people. So it is helping with, you know, if you live in the desert in the middle of Africa, I'm sure like, yay, you have Wi-Fi because you can connect to Starlink and you're a wealthy person.
Yeah.
But like for the average American, it's not really helping, and it's not really been the effective program that everyone was hoping that it was, because the United States tends to lean towards, let's let the free market solve it. And Elon Musk said, I'm going to solve it. And then it didn't really get solved. So I think the issue that need, my opinion, and I think a lot of other Americans will agree with me, is the United States needs to set aside tens of billions of dollars and stop sanctioning China and other countries who already have finished developing 5.5G telecommunications equipment, and buy that telecommunications equipment, install it, and after the government has set it all up, if they want to privatize it, sell it off to different companies, break up some of the big companies, and then it will become accessible. And if the big companies are broken up so there's more competition, it will become more affordable. Mm. But sanctioning the most advanced telecommunications country in the world, China, and not investing in our own infrastructure is a recipe for, you know, stagnation, for staying in the past, for having Wi-Fi levels and internet access at 1990.
I mean, nowadays with a lot of these AI tools being open source and even bigger companies that are opening up to the public, it's really a time for opening up and not closing down if you want to go forward.
Yeah, absolutely. AI, it's like the new laptop or the new computer. People in the 1980s, they were like, if you want to stay relevant, get a computer and learn how to use it. Mm. And that will keep you in the company. You apply for a job, you say, I can use computers. In 1989, people are like, you're hired. Right now, that's what's going on. AI is not replacing jobs. It's replacing people who don't know how to use AI.
True.
So now jobs are like, can you use AI? Great, you're hired. Can you use these 5 AI programs? No. We'll have to think about whether or not we're going to hire you. So at this point in the United States, you have, if 1 in 5 families are being potentially cut off from internet access, that means 20% of Americans are going to be falling behind the global curve using the most advanced technologies in the world. So Europeans and Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, and so forth, all these other advanced countries who do have really advanced internet access, and this is really important for them, they're using the technologies that are going to lead into the 22nd century.
Yeah.
And Americans are like, I can't get on Facebook.
That's my biggest worry for a lot of these technological advancements. And I've always felt the same way, that it's going to leave a huge part of the population behind. And if it's just because they are less, let's say, literate on, not as literate on technology as the young people are, that's fine. You know, there are ways to bring them to keep them up to speed with things. But if it's because they don't have enough time, they don't have enough access to the internet, and that's why they're being left behind. It's only going to become faster and faster. Changes only are only going to happen at a faster speed as we go forward with all of these crazy technologies. And if these people can't even have the most basic access to it, because at some point now we still look at AI when I think, oh, well, this is what's this is fancy stuff. You're creating this, creating that. But you also have to realize that in other aspects of our daily lives, AI is being used even more widely. Its application is even more extensive than we think. And soon enough, I think that a lot of aspects of our life will require us to rely heavily on internet access. What are you going to do then? At that point, you're still going to say, oh, we don't have enough money for the program so that these people can't have internet. That'll be almost a human rights issue at that point.
You know, that's actually a really good point, human rights issue, because despite what people may know about government, the United Nations does have policies for the way that all countries around the world are supposed to be developing. And the United States, you know, tries in part to follow some of those guidelines. China is the good student who's always like doing exactly what they're supposed to do, by the way. And one of those things is called the Gini Index. And this index is an index for disparity between the wealthy and the poor. And it should not be out of a certain range in each consecutive period of time. There are conferences about how to narrow this index and to make so the poorest classes and the richest classes are not so divided, because these kinds of divides create terrible situations where human rights are thrown in the gutter and the rich are just like, yay, everything's great. And they don't even understand how bad the situation for the poor is. Now, obviously, if you look at different countries around the world, you have rich and poor. You look in China, you have rich and poor. And you look in the United States, you have rich and poor. So it's not like it doesn't exist. But what you said is really important, is if there are people like in San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and so forth, Chicago, et cetera, Seattle, and they have wonderful, screaming, fast internet, it's plugged into the wall, and they're doing great things with AI and advancing their own careers and stuff. And then you have someone in rural Arizona living out in the desert, and they have nothing, and the only access they have to the internet is driving their car to the local library. Then you're creating the conditions that cause disparity. Here's an article on that. This is from brookings.edu. That's an education website by Blair Levin. The end of the affordable connectivity program is almost here, threatening to widen the digital divide. And so this is an argument that people are already realizing. And it also mentions in the ACP, the Affordable Connectivity Program, provides $30 per month subsidy. So it helps these 23 million homes who would run out, according to this article, who would run out of funds sometime in April or May of 2024. So if it doesn't get renewed, then essentially we're going to create a new way in which disparity increases. We can create a new way in which the United States becomes more of those who have and those who don't have. And this is already a problem in the United States for so many other reasons. You know, like we have huge amounts of billionaires and we have about 1 million people who are homeless. Officially, the figure is 650,000. Most people agree that the amount of homeless people is actually vastly underreported and understood, and maybe 1 or 2 million people living in tent cities all across America, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle. But I mean, we're literally making the conditions to make this potentially worse by not giving people access to the internet. And this is not just about, I mean, it should be. It's not just about these homeless people or the potential future homeless people or the people who are increasingly falling under the American machine as it rolls forward. It's not just about them. It's also about America. Because if they're cut off from these skills, these technologies, from the opportunity to take classes online and improve their lives and get jobs online and have work online, then the U.S. economy suffers. And that affects everyone in the United States. So if the United States, if the lawmakers, if the leaders of our country want America to succeed, and whatever they think about the poor, if they want America to succeed, then they need to help these people participate in the digital economy, because increasingly the digital economy is a huge pillar of the actual economy.
Think about the digital divide. I like the alliteration as well, just to personal pet peeve. think about the digital divide that is getting wider. Nowadays, there are already If you need to go look for a job, you need to go what they ask you to e-sign, they ask you to send in your stuff, they ask you to email them. And these things, we hear it as something that just happens so often. And yeah, you just go, yeah, sure, without even thinking, because internet access is never something that you have to worry about. But if these people in the future, if they were indeed affected by the stopping of the program, it'll be kind of crazy for them to, if they want to step up, if they want to change their life, they want to move themselves up further, and internet ends up being something mm-hmm. that blocks them from getting that, it'll be a little bit like a joke. For me, it's kind of like, you know, hey, we want, people need to ride the subway, but instead of like government spending money making the subway infrastructure really, really, really accessible and find a way to make it work, find the business model, do the math and make the whole thing work. And let's try to bring the price down to a point where most people can ride the subway. Instead, they're like, you know what? This is the math that we did. So the rich people or people that can't have it, they'll just have to pay for this, like a really high price to access it. Other people, well, we don't want them to just completely be cussed out of the subway system. Let's give them a little discount, but the discount is limited. this is our solution to the whole problem. That's the best. I think that's a great analogy that I could come up. And it really goes back to the point where how you spend. I think, of course, this money right now, there needs to be more money that goes into the program so that these people could maintain their access to the internet. But what's the ultimate solution to this problem? I think infrastructure really is one of the most viable answers.
I completely agree with you. I think that's actually a huge difference between the way that China operates and the way the United States operates. Now, I'm not going to say, oh, America's capitalist and China is socialist. It's not exactly accurate. The United States is actually quite socialist. We have a lot of socialist programs. We have all kinds of Medicare and Medi-Cal in California, and there's a Social Security. And,
oh God, they have a Medi-Cal.
Yeah, they have their own medical program, and we have all kinds of socialist programs in the United States. And this is kind of a socialist program. It's like providing internet for the people with the least amount of access, who are in the worst kinds of conditions, and so we can make sure that they don't fall so far behind. So that, you know, the United States is not this pure capitalist place that people imagine. It is a kind of socialist economy. It has elements of socialism mixed up. And the thing about it is, China was like, okay, we need 45, we want high-speed rail. So the government's like, okay, we're building high-speed rail. And that's great because it has all these SOEs and it has a mixed economy. And so it's able to just like make command decisions. The government builds it out. And then in some cases, it privatizes it or puts it in the hands of SOEs and so forth. But the United States is more reticent about their philosophy. There are a lot of leaders who are like, oh, no, we need to let the market handle everything. So we're not going to do that. We're not going to do this. And we're not going to do these other things. Now, what's happened is the United States is falling behind, not just behind China, but behind Europe, behind all these other countries all over the world, which are more prone to like, okay, you know, we are going to build rail and that's going to be a government thing. Maybe or maybe not, we will privatize it in some way or shape or another. And so all these other countries are building stuff. And the United States is just like, don't worry, the right CEO is going to come along and just make it all magically happen for us. And this magical thinking, this faith in this invisible hand is holding the United States
back. Yeah, oh my God.
And so, you know, we Americans are already a kind of socialist economy. We just need to extend it to a couple more things like infrastructure. And then, hey, the United States could keep up with the rest of the world. But as it is, the United States is falling behind. And that is not something I think most Americans are prepared to handle. And so I think there's a huge debate going on. But the people who are like, we need schools and high-speed rail and, like, you know, telecommunications, their voices are drowned out by these other people who are like, no, the free market will do it for us. It's not, though.
I really want to. It's really sad. Maybe this is naive for me to say. Maybe it's uneducated or unsophisticated for me to say. But a lot of times when things are put in labels, you give yourself these walls. You put yourself in these boxes of what I can or cannot do. And honestly, at this point, I think I'm constantly being paranoid of the day where, like, you know, AI breaks that limit of being sentient or whatever. And it starts to really create things. And there's going going to be two parallel universes where people who didn't catch up, who didn't get to jump on the bandwagon and go like go forward with the technology advancement, and versus people who are lucky enough to always be in that. And imagine how big of the gap there is going to be between these two groups of people. Maybe we can't even, because right now a lot of us can't even imagine how much work AI can do, mm-hmm. And how fast it's going to evolve and develop. And at that point, I feel like a lot of the basic things, it's really not about whether who's a capitalist or who's socialist and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's about, as a government, what's your function? Are you going to keep this country moving forward? Yeah, sure. If you want to keep this country moving forward, if you want to keep it as a country and a stable society, then there are just things that you have to do. It's not about socialism or capitalism. Mm. It's not about the labels. But, you know, scholars or social scientists might disagree. Politicians might disagree. But for as just a member of the society, as one of the citizens, the civilians that's just trying to make ends meet and trying to survive, I don't think people care so much about whether this is a socialist policy or this is a capitalist policy. We just want to have food on our table and internet in our house, yeah. And our mobile devices, mm-hmm. so that we can stay connected to the world. It's simple as that.
I agree with you. I think most common sense people also feel that way. Probably most Americans, if you say, okay, what defines socialism, they have no idea what it is anyway. So
exactly.
But I want to make two points that I think are interesting. One is this is from an article. It's the same one that I was just reading. The end of affordable connectivity program is almost here, threatening to widen the divide. And it mentions in the article, and it was the point that I was kind of making before, that and it is not just those families who will bear the cost. And then I'm going to skip a couple lines. It says, a recent economics working paper estimated that for every dollar spent on the ACP, the nation's GDP increases by $3.89. So we're literally getting almost four times back what we're investing into this program to help people. And that's ignoring the fact that it helps people, which are, you know, I think should matter. I think it should matter that there is an old lady like in the countryside who can't call her grandkids. I think that matters. But if we're just looking at it from a national perspective, it's actually a compound increaser of wealth for the country. So, I mean, there's that. I want to talk about something else, though, because you keep bringing up AI, and I think it's a really relevant point in terms of if we're talking about internet access.
It is.
I was watching a speech by the president of NVIDIA, and he mentioned that we are at a point where we don't need coders. He said, in the 1990s, I told people, teach your kids to code. Now I would tell them, don't teach your kids to code. And he said, we're at the point where the loop is closed. Anything a coder can do can be done without a coder.
Wow.
And he mentioned a kind of software that makes apps. It's an app for making apps. So I went online and I found this app for making apps. And basically, you draw a picture on a sheet of paper with words that describe what each part of your picture that you've drawn should do. Take a picture and upload it to the app. And then it automatically generates a version of the app that you envisioned. Mm-hmm. And you can just change the colors and shapes and sizes. And then you have created an app that will do the things that you imagined. And it will automatically generate a completely new app for you out of thin air. I did this. I created one of the this program already exists, but I created a program that creates a moving wallpaper that exists behind your icons. And it generated an application that can do that. So now I can go to YouTube and download a 10-second long clip of something cool and then put it into this application that it automatically generated for me. And that is my wallpaper. And even though that already exists, I just was doing it as a test to see if I could do it using AI. So AI literally has the ability to make applications out of thin air without the ability to code. So it's just remarkable. And so these people who don't have access to the internet, they're like generations behind where we are moving.
Exactly.
We need to ensure that all people everywhere have access to the internet, because things are happening so fast that it's head spinning, I think.
Yeah, imagine if you say, this is the conversation, say, oh, did you see this thing that is really helpful? You want to change your life? You're having an ankle problem? Oh, there's one way that's going to help you solve it really fast. You just need to go do this. Oh, you don't know how to do that? Go on YouTube and watch a video. video.
Right.
And
yeah.
The person goes, let me find where I can have unlimited data, unlimited.
Right. On Sunday, I'm going to the library.
I'll watch it then. Yeah.
Yeah. And also it mentions in the same article, last thought on this, this is that telehealth for patients with cancer ranged between $147, $186 per visit. But according to the University of Pennsylvania, showing that telemedicine was 23% less expensive than in-person visits. So you can call your doctor on the internet, have a Skype call or a Zoom call or whatever they're using these days, and talk to your doctor and get, you know, advice about your condition for considerably less money than driving to the hospital, number one, paying for all the gas to go, and then paying your hospital visit, and then driving home. So, and plus, in addition to losing the time, you lose the gas money, and you have to pay a higher bill. But if you could just do it from home, you know, 5 minutes passes by, now you are able to maybe take the advice of your physician and move on with your life. So it impacts people in so many different ways. I would like to hear your opinion, listener. Please let us know what you think we got wrong, what got right, or what you would like to add to this conversation. We would be happy to read your comments on the air. Please email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. Thank you so much for your time, listeners. Thank you so much for your time, Alex.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, everyone. And hooray, internet.